Hello and welcome to this episode of the Conference Conversations Focus 2022 podcast series. In this episode, Erin McIntyre, physiotherapist and PhD candidate at the University of South Australia, and Tim Austin, specialist pain physiotherapist working in primary and secondary healthcare in Sydney, chat about the clinical effectiveness of a novel physiotherapy VR intervention that has direct relevance for physiotherapy practice. Before we start, this series of Conference Conversations podcasts has been brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, supporting the promotion and translation of research, and supported by Pain Away, platinum and content sponsor of the PRF. Let's get started.
Hi everyone, my name's Tim Austin and I'm the National Chair of the Pain Special Interest Group of the APA. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this recording has been made, the Wurundjeri people, and the lands from which you are listening. And I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. So I'd like to welcome in this podcast Erin McIntyre. Welcome, Erin.
Welcome. Thank you.
Your title of your research is Getting Your Head in the Game. It's a novel virtual reality intervention for people with chronic low back pain. So getting your head in the game, what is it? What are we talking about here?
With this project, we really want to make exercise a little bit more fun. So I'm a physio, that's my background. And often with physiotherapy interventions, things like exercise that we know are really good for low back pain, we know they're really good, but they're often a little bit boring. So that's what we really want to do with this, is make it a lot more engaging, entertaining, making it an intervention that patients actually want to do long term. And so that was kind of the real basis behind this research here.
So it literally is getting your head in the game. A virtual reality. So tell us what the virtual reality is, and obviously using a headset. So can you just explain what that is before we look at what this trial was all about?
In this case, we had people wear the full headset. So they had the headset on, they had microphones on the side or speakers on the side so they could have not just visual imagery, but also kind of the multi-sensory, the sound of the game. They're also holding handsets, so they had both of their hands tracked with the game, and they're really able to interact with the environment. So we got them with all that equipment on, and then they played three different games. Two of them are commercially available games. You can get them today on whatever platform, virtual reality platform you're using. And that was it. Really engaging, really fun. Have you ever tried virtual reality before?
No, I haven't. That's why I'm delighted to do this podcast, because I'm the first one to get to listen to it. Because we're going to talk as we move through this podcast about the clinical relevance of this. Now, I know this is just very early research, but you can already start to see where this might have its clinical application. But if we sort of get back to, the methodology of this, it'd be useful to explain to people exactly who you chose, the people with back pain. Maybe if we deal with that first, who were the subjects in your trial?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. So I guess the methodology is a little bit complex, especially for clinicians, because it's different than your kind of classic randomized controlled trial. We did kind of a single case experimental trial. What that means is that we only look at a small number of people, but we measure their outcomes daily. So we track them daily for 35 days. Within that 35 days, we give them an intervention. But because we're asking them kind of constantly daily how they're going, what their pain is, we can, with a small number of people, still see the effect of the intervention on those participants. So we only were aiming to recruit 10 people for the study because we're still able to be able to derive quite a bit of power, understand this phenomenon quite completely with a small amount of people. So we recruited 10 people, 9 of them were analyzed. And it's kind of interesting, I guess, as a woman, we did consecutive sampling from a physiotherapy clinic. Of those 9 people, we ended up with 8 men. So not a lot of diversity, which kind of bothers me. So we'll definitely have to follow up on that. However, we did have a diversity of ages. So it was the mean age was 44 years old. We had everyone from 28-year-old to 63-year-olds, which is actually really cool because I think there's this kind of conception of virtual reality being for young people. But here we kind of show that, you know, lots and lots of people can participate in this intervention. It's not just for the youth of the day.
Yeah, that's an immediate application point is, whilst it's a sort of early data and an early trial, just the applicability across different ages and obviously getting a bit more diversity amongst the mix would be quite helpful. We're talking about people with chronic low back pain, and so amongst these nine people, their duration of symptoms were quite lengthy?
Yes, we only include people who had pain for at least 3 months. And we also had an additional inclusion criteria about their pain being relatively stable over the 2 weeks prior to the study. This was to make sure that we could actually kind of a little bit more definitively say the intervention was, you know, paired to their decrease in pain versus them just having, you know, an acute kind of episode of low back pain that we know will most likely resolve kind of within that 6 week mark anyways. So we purposely looked for people who had relatively long-standing pain, but also relatively stable pain.
Yeah, obviously easier to sort of research on. And I think your one person who you didn't continue with was somebody who didn't meet that criteria.
Yeah. So the one person I mentioned that we didn't analyze, they somehow snuck in. So they had a kind of a 1 out of 10 pain rating on the NRS scale when they came into the trial. So we exclude them. They didn't meet our inclusion criteria. And I mean, if you're starting at 1 out of 10, we can't really improve that too much.
No, that's right. Maybe they just wanted to do some virtual reality. So the things you measured,
Yeah. Share
with us. I know obviously you measured pain intensity, and that was, am I correct? The pain intensity was the key variable, primary outcome?
Exactly. That was kind of the one that we are most focused on. So we used a 0 to 10 NRS scale for pain intensity. We also looked at pain catastrophizing, pain-related fear and anxiety. And I guess the cool thing about this methodology is that we're getting daily outcome measures. So we only took a few items from those scales because we were asking them every single day to fill out these 10 questions on a questionnaire. So we had to be quite specific about what we were asking them.
That in itself is fascinating data, isn't it, about the consistency of asking. I think there is some research around whether those variables might change. Are there issues with regards to measuring some of these outcomes on a daily basis, itself being an influence on those outcomes?
I think that's definitely a consideration. We've kind of controlled for that in two different ways. First of all of our participants had a baseline period. So we asked them these daily questions for a good length of time, at least 5 days before we started the intervention, to start to control for asking the same question repeatedly. Also, if we want to get really technical in the stats, we have, I guess, what we call autocorrelation. So if you say your pain is 4 out of 10 one day, the next day it's going to be more likely that you also say 4 out of 10. What that means is that our responses are never going to be normally distributed, which is a requirement for most of our kind of statistical analyses. So we actually brought a statistician on board to help us with the analysis because it becomes quite complex, and used for our modeling types of statistical tests that account for that. So I guess those two factors is a consideration, but because we use those two kind of factors, we were more confident that we were able to control for those potential confounders.
And like any good research project, it certainly reminds us why we need our statisticians and research methodology experts, doesn't it?
Oh goodness. Yes, definitely. I find this research method really, really great, fascinating. I think it's a cool one for physiotherapy trials because you don't need huge resources to be able to get really good, high quality data. However, the downside to it is it's really, really specialized in terms of your knowledge of the study methodology, the stats. It becomes a lot more complicated kind of on that back end side of things.
Yeah. But it is the classic of an N equals one trial, isn't it? Because you're measuring these people related to themselves.
Yeah.
And so when again, we've got our ear out for what the clinical applications are here that we're looking at individuals and to see how much they do actually change. Just now in terms of the actual intervention, so these are people with low back pain, their goggles on, and you get them to play some games in order to do what?
We were really trying to focus the games to encourage kind of lumbar flexion, just because that seems to be, you know, I think clinically we can all agree that seems to be one of those more difficult movements for people with low back pain. So we're really encouraging them to bend further and further forward. But in a game situation, so they're not kind of consciously aware that they're bending forward repeatedly. It's more, I have to hit this target. I have to reach down towards my knees to achieve that goal. So rather than it being kind of a very explicit, you must bend your back forward, you know, 50 times during this session, it's the game parameters are really getting you to do that movement repeatedly.
What's fascinating about that is I think of clinical sessions where, in a sense, we try and do that, but we don't have the ability of that immense amount of distraction.
Yeah.
You know, we will ask people to do various things in life. We may get them to do various things in the clinic, but in a sense, it's hard for them to be blinded to what you're trying to do, whereas it's almost like the virtual reality itself is a blinded experiment.
Yeah. Maybe you can say that. And I think that actually gets to a really fascinating thing about virtual reality. This experiment can answer this question, but something that I'm personally quite interested in, it's how virtual reality is working to change someone's pain. I think if we go in a bit of a history lesson, initially when we introduced virtual reality to treating pain, we thought that it was using it as a distraction. So the classic studies are with burn patients and having their bandages changed, which is an incredibly painful and horrible experience. So they actually brought in this Snow World VR experience. So they got the virtual reality goggles on. They had snowmen and snow kind of all around them, kind of the opposite of the heat and the burn and those associations. And that was actually quite effective for that acute pain relief. And then we tried to translate that across to chronic pain. But that distraction didn't seem to work so well with chronic pain, because as soon as you were not immersed in that lovely environment in the virtual reality goggles, your pain came back, right?
Yeah. What I think's interesting in what you just said was that, again, there's no one thing that virtual reality is. So as you said, we've seen virtual reality as a distraction. Yeah, I mean, you're just like playing somebody a video of Scandinavia and feeling good about it. But we've got virtual reality where we could change the size of people's limbs or things like that. And in this, it's actually a graded activity approach. So we haven't talked about that graded activity, because that's pivotal to this research, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's trying to get someone to engage in the amount of dose that we have to and long-term adhere to kind of that graded activity approach.
So how exactly did the games do the graded activity approach?
Yeah, so before we got participants to do the games, we kind of graded them so that we create an easy level, a medium level, and a hard level. So in the easy level, which is where everyone started off, they were only had to reach kind of small amounts. So they only had to bend a little bit forward. And then medium levels, it was, you know, the targets were more towards mid-trunk, and then the harder levels were even further forward. So that way we were able to kind of start them all at the easy levels and then grade them up.
And was that done individually for each person?
Yeah.
So what was a small amount for one person could have been quite different to what the small amount was for another person.
Yeah, so I guess the easy, medium, and hard levels were kind of preset, and everyone did the same easy, medium, and hard. Also, when you're doing virtual reality, the headset kind of knows where it is in space. So if you put it on a taller person, that's going to kind of adjust it for them. So it kind of works itself out in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that does. So there's some degree of individualization. And then in terms of the number of sessions, am I correct? There was a different length of time before the intervention started, but everybody had 2 to 3 sessions a week for 2 to 3 weeks.
So one of the ways that we're able to tell if the intervention influenced pain was by randomizing how long their baseline was. So it wasn't just, you know, 5 days into the study, everyone starts the virtual reality component. We randomized them to different lengths of baselines so that if we did see a change, we could kind of pin that change to when that intervention started, not when they started the trial.
No, that does make sense. And then the length of time of the intervention was, again, a little variable, but about 2 to 3 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, actually quite variable. I think the longest intervention period was 21 days and the shortest was 14 days, which gave us a really interesting effect where some people did, you know, 6 sessions and some people did 9 sessions of the virtual reality. And while we didn't have, I guess, the number of people to formally test this, what we did observe is that the people who did more physiotherapy sessions, more virtual reality sessions, actually tended to do better. So there may be a dose response relationship there.
Yes, which brings us to obviously results, which is why we're all here, tantalized.
Pain Away is Australia's number one joint and muscle spray and cream topical pain relief brand containing arnica and naturally derived active ingredients. The entire range of Pain Away sprays, creams and tablets is made in Australia by Australians for Australians. Always read the label, follow the directions for use. If symptoms persist, talk to your health professional.
You love being a physio. You work hard to be your best. You are driven to help others.
Research is the backbone of the physio profession, and the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, the PRF, is all about research. We offer research grants, promote research, and make it easy for you to access the latest research by creating bite-sized content so you can stay up to date and on the front foot.
We know you are passionate about delivering the latest, effective, evidence-based care to your patients.
And as an APA member, you are directly contributing to the PRF. Thank you for your support so we can continue helping you to be your best.
You are the PRF.
To learn more about the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, head to australian.physio/PRF.
You've already indicated in terms of the demographics that males were all but one and the age was quite spread. So the outcomes, I know this is what you really want to share. There were some average changes over the group, but then we'll talk a bit more about some people who might have responded better than others. So the primary outcome, pain, what happened there?
Yeah, pain intensity, when we did our very fancy statistical modelling, we found that over the course of the intervention, there's an average decrease of 1 point on the 0 to 10 NRS scale. So people's pain decreased by that point, and that was statistically significant. However, I know as well as you do, 1 point on a 10-point scale, as a clinician, as a patient, that's not super meaningful. So the exciting thing was really that four of our participants met the clinically relevant threshold, which is a drop of greater than 30% of their pain. So four people achieved that, which is a bit more exciting, I think, as a clinician, as a patient.
Yeah, absolutely. This is just so important to the research that if we spreading this out to so many other research trials over decades, if we just, I mean, of course, there's arguments around whether pain intensity is relevant or not, but what we're talking about here is trying to work out who's responding and how much it's actually responding to.
Yeah, much more mixed results there. We did see a statistically significant reduction in catastrophizing, similar to the pain intensity, but not so much of the, there wasn't as much of a clinical significance there, where people had, you know, large reductions in pain catastrophizing.
So we've got 30% reduction in pain for four out of nine of the people. The secondary variables, so catastrophizing, fear, anxiety.
Yeah, it definitely. One of the really cool things about having so few participants is that when we present the results, we actually plot everyone's individual, I guess, course through the trial on graphs, and then we can look at them as kind of a, you know, those nine people. And so when it looked with pain intensity, you could kind of see there's clear, you know, four lovely responders to it. The others, there's two that were kind of quite low the whole trial, and then two more who just stayed quite high. But then when we looked at our secondary variables, it was just dog's breakfast. It was all over the shop. So it was much harder to see just with the visual analysis any compelling trends, which was reflected in, I guess, statistical modeling as well, which is quite nice. And so I think, you know, we measured these secondary variables because we were kind of interested to almost why this is working, you know, because pain intensity is one thing. But if we see both a big drop in pain intensity, but also pain-related fear, we could kind of say, oh, maybe this is similar to a graded exposure intervention where we're really reducing people's pain or fear of movement and their pain. And maybe that's how that's working. So we could further refine, I guess, the intervention to really focus on that. but we didn't really have any compelling results for secondary variables. So, yeah.
And were those changes in catastrophizing similar to pain in that the average was down, but was it quite mixed amongst the various subjects as well?
Yeah, it definitely. One of the really cool things about having so few participants is that when we present the results, we actually plot everyone's individual course through the trial on graphs, and then we can look at them as those 9 people. And so when it looked, you know, at with pain intensity, you could kind of see there's clear 4 lovely responders to it. The others, there's 2 that were kind of quite low the whole trial, and then 2 more who just stayed quite high. But then when we looked at our secondary variables, it was just a dog's breakfast. It was all over the shop. So it was much harder to see just with the visual analysis any compelling trends, which was reflected in, I guess, statistical modeling as well, which is quite nice. And so I think, you know, we measured these secondary variables because we were kind of interested to almost why this is working, you know, because pain intensity is one thing. But if we see both a big drop in pain intensity, but also pain-related fear, we could kind of say, oh, maybe this is similar to a graded exposure intervention where we're really reducing people's pain or fear of movement and their pain. And maybe that's how that's working. So we could further refine, I guess, the intervention to really focus on that. But we didn't really have any compelling results for secondary variables. So, yeah.
No, you've given a part answer to something that intrigued me, that this is a graded activity approach, not a graded exposure approach. So there's perhaps that sort of argument that because it wasn't an overt attention to the fear in terms of exposure, that there is that sense, isn't there, with graded exposure that you've got to be a bit more specific to expose people. Yeah. And possibly that's something that could be included in future research, couldn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think it really gets back to something that really intrigues me is how these interventions work. If you think of doing a graded exposure intervention in virtual reality, conceptually actually kind of falls apart because graded exposure is you're confronting your fears, you know, really directly. It has to be really realistic and specific to something that you are really worried about. If we're taking someone into a virtual world, you're kind of transporting them away from that. And so it's not quite as realistic, you know, it's not kind of directly getting them to confront that fear. So conceptually, it doesn't make as much sense. And I think as well, there's some really cool research going on about using VR as a medium to achieve different types of intervention. So we've talked about graded activity and graded exposure. We've talked about the distraction. Dan Harvey's doing some really cool research looking at different embodiments or multisensory integration and how if we get someone to embody, say, the body of a Hulk and they feel really strong and really powerful, does that help their pain, you know? And then if it does, how does that actually translate back to the real world from a virtual world? So that's why I think VR as a research stream is really interesting because we can really take it down lots of different ways if we have strong kind of theoretical constructs behind what we're doing.
So Erin, one of the great things about this trial was that engagement was high. You got the subjects that they all continued with it. You must be very proud of yourself to achieve that.
Well, I'm very proud of Maya. So Maya is the physio who actually ran the intervention and she was fantastic. You know, she put some effort into making sure people came back and was really accommodating to schedules. But you're right. I think it's really cool to see a 100% adherence to an intervention because that's really, really hard to achieve, especially if we're thinking about this population, people with low back pain, you know, often the interventions are either painful or boring, and neither of those make them quite attractive to do. So we often find adherence to these kind of things quite low. So the fact that we had 100% adherence is probably, to me, the most exciting result.
Yeah. And I do wonder whether, again, we know engagement and having a good research person who's involved and our administration staff, whether we're doing research or whether we're doing clinical practice, those are the other variables that confound research.
Yeah.
but they're part of clinically how we get people better. And I was intrigued your thoughts here about, so you had 10 people, you had one in a sense drop out and everybody else progressed from which you got 4 responders. That's an incredibly high rate. When you start with 10 and you found four responders, 40% of the people who were your start point responded. That's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that. Thank you. You're very kind right now.
But how do you think moving on from here we can find out who those responders are? Do you have some thoughts? I know your research doesn't always tell us that at the moment, but what are you feeling? Maybe it's a question about where this research goes from here.
Yeah, I think, you know, picking out who's going to respond to an intervention, that's the million-dollar question. And there's whole groups trying to research that question, because currently we've tried subgrouping and trying to, you know, tailor our interventions to people specifically. And we haven't really figured out how to do that. We haven't had much success with it. So it would be lovely to know, but I think that's one of those questions that's going to be really, really hard. And I hope someone else answers it, because I don't like their luck.
Part of it's those correlations that you speculate on. You speculate that were the people that responded, is the pain intensity related to the reduction in the catastrophizing? Were there some people who had fear that dropped and others that didn't? I mean, those are the things that all of the other research trials in all other interventions try and explore, those sort of things. For the clinician, so there's plenty of clinicians listening to this podcast, what does your research say to them as they are treating people, who some of whom are getting better, some of whom aren't? What do they take from the work that you and others are doing in this space?
I think this kind of speaks to VR maybe being another tool in your clinical toolkit, right? You know, it's kind of saying, if you're having trouble, you know, engaging someone with an intervention, they maybe want to do a behavioral change intervention, they want to get a little bit more active, but they're struggling just from a pure motivation perspective, we could kind of think, oh, something like virtual reality could be something that allows them to stick with it a little bit more. And it's not the only tool. It could be, you know, they want to get active, but they only like playing, you know, footy. And that's their kind of hook into physical activity. I look at virtual reality kind of similar. You know, it's something that you could offer and play with to try to just hook them in, maintain that engagement with it. So that's what I think this study kind of says, is this is another option. It has been effective in this small cohort that we've looked at. And yeah, have some permission to have a bit of fun and try something different and new.
All right, so we've given the listeners permission for fun. The fun police won't be out there. Just as we sort of come to I suppose, that conclusion around the engagement, adherence is one of the things that's obviously been researched by lots of people with their intervention. And again, there seems that it was obviously highly adherent to the group, and it was fun. They did get their head in the game. Is that what we're seeing here, that again, another opportunity to get people to adhere to an exercise regime or an activity regime? Is that what we're seeing?
That's what I think we're seeing. Yeah. And I think that's how my gut instinct is why we've kind of seen an effect here. But I guess it's hard to say. Just, I know this is going to be me sounding very much like a researcher, but our study design wasn't set up to answer that question, so we have no idea.
You've been trained very well, Erin, very well. And with regards to the other ways in which we can get adherence, we also look at potentially hooking this to other known interventions. So we've got pain education as an intervention. When it's done in a very individualised way, we do have exposure that you talked about. Do you possibly see that we'll build a different interventions, I suppose commoditizing it to some extent, but also individualizing it, packaging it might be the best way of saying it, once our assessment sees various things that we could implement, that we might need to look at that package?
Yeah, I think I understand your question. You know, I believe that no treatment should be provided in isolation. So we know, especially for persistent pain, you know, a multimodal, multidisciplinary approach is almost always needed, and that's where we get the best results. So I would say something like virtual reality would be best placed in a broader treatment context, where it's not just the virtual reality by itself, it is that education, it is kind of a social support intervention, it is, you know, seeing the doctor, everything together. to create kind of an individualized package of care, because I think that's where we do tend to see better results rather than just one. You know, there's no magic bullet, unfortunately. There's no one thing that's going to fix everything for everyone. It's individualizing it and providing that person support from lots of different angles.
Yeah, and I was thinking for myself as a clinical application, it's perhaps being more thoughtful about what is it that I'm doing that gets engagement, what am I doing that gets adherence to what I'm doing, and having a bit more of a radar out for patients for whom that might be a challenge and thinking outside the box as to what you might be able to offer them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fantastic. You can have the best intervention in the world, but if someone doesn't want to participate in it, it's absolutely useless.
That's it. That's right. And so we're back to our responders again.
And also just thinking, you know, how can I make this fun and creative? How can I think outside the box? Because traditional tried and true methods don't always work. So where can we have some fun with this?
Fun. That might be a lovely place to end our podcast. So I'd like to thank again Erin McIntyre for her research, Getting Your Head in the Game. It's made us think about virtual reality and how it might help our patients, particularly those with chronic low back pain. So thanks again, Erin.
No worries. I hope we had some fun with this one too.
We have indeed.
That was Erin McIntyre, physiotherapist and PhD candidate at the University of South Australia, and Tim Austin, a specialist pain physiotherapist working in primary and secondary healthcare in Sydney. You've been listening to another episode of Conference Conversations, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation and Pain Away, platinum and content sponsor of the PRF. Thanks for listening, and make sure you catch the next episode in the Conference Conversations podcast series.